Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Sue Fraser. Before the official part of today's luncheon, there are a few thank yous on behalf of the Press Club Committee that I would like to do. We would like to, first of all, acknowledge our sponsors, being Optus Communications, Qantas, for having flown in our guest speaker, and also to SA Brewing for the Hahn Premium that's available for your enjoyment today. Would you thank those people? I'd like to extend a very warm welcome to the representatives of those companies who are here today. And ladies and gentlemen, if you're not personally on our mailing list for the lunch invitations and you'd like to receive one every month, would you please speak to any member of the Press Club Committee, the news editors of the radio and television stations, to Tony O'Brien, Judith Bleachmore or myself, and we'd be more than happy to put you on our mailing list. Now, to help pay for those stamps, we have our normal little $2 raffle on the table. So if you haven't found the raffle envelope, please find it and please buy a raffle ticket. And let me tell you what you're going to win today. We have a $50 voucher from Rigoni's Bistro in Lee Street. It's lovely. Some nice Italian food at famous Rigoni's. Also a $50 voucher from the Rock Lobster Cafe, which is in Googer Street. The wonderful Rock Lobster. And you are able to take, somebody's able to take 10 of their friends. We have 10 tickets to the Royal Adelaide Show, which is on right now. So you can take 10 of your friends and have a great time. Thank you to Francine Connor. And also, are you listening to me? Shh. That excited you, didn't it? We also have a carton of Hahn Premium beer, thanks to Robbie Cooter at SA Brewing. So snap up those $2 tickets. Now, if you have your mobile phone with you, as a courtesy to our guest speaker, would you please turn it off right now, lest we embarrass you? Finally, I know that you're all eager to hear our guest speaker. And to make the introduction, would you please welcome back Robert Main. Thank you.
Thank you, Sue, very much. You're a bundle of lively energy. It's good to see so many of you here today. To be honest, I'm not quite sure who are the poachers and who are the gamekeepers. I guess Stuart Littlemore is a poacher turned gamekeeper. He was a journalist of distinction who turned to the law around about 1978, I think, roughly. Stuart, am I right? And he now practices in Phillip Street, Sydney. In fact, he'd forgotten that, until I reminded him earlier on today, that he won a defamation case for me many years ago, in which I managed to get some money from Channel 7 and 9 in Sydney. Thanks you all for joining us today. Although, come to think about it, where else could you get a QC to talk to give you advice for 30 minutes for 30 or 40 bucks? We will have some questions after Stuart speaks, and I'd now like to invite him to come and talk to us on a most interesting occasion. I bet he doesn't even mention the word paparazzi.
Always nice to hear from a satisfied customer. Thank you for having me, ladies and gentlemen. Can I tell you that the title of today's lesson is Professional Fouls or Misconduct in the Mass Media? As Robert has told you, I'm a lawyer, so let me start with a law. The Trade Practices Act, Section 52, which says, a corporation shall not in trade or commerce engage in conduct that is misleading or deceptive. The Australian Consumer and Competition Commission has provided me with the following summary of some of the successful prosecutions conducted under that Act over the past year, and they include these. Telstra, which will have to pay $45 million in refunds as a result of misleading telephone customers about its maintenance plan. The Vales Wine Company fined $165,000 for false claims as to the vintage and description of its product. TNT Australia, which had to give an enforceable undertaking after misleading representations as to its means of transporting goods, and something called On Clinic Australia, against which an injunction was granted to restrain misleading representations about its impotency treatments. Quite unfamiliar to any persons in this room. Now, what you notice about those four major actions in respect of false and misleading conduct in trade is that none of them had as the defendant an Australian mass media corporation. I'll tell you the reason for that shortly. But first, let me give you the 1997 Media Watch rundown of the guilty among our mass media, guilty of false and misleading conduct in their trade. These are just some of the serious transgressions we've picked up in our program so far this year in just 6 months. First, you find a prejudice and you milk it dry. The Murdoch Telegraph's clone story from the Murdoch London Sun original, well, it was hardly an original there either, putting flesh on the conjecture of the saloon bar commentator, you know, the one who says, let's send out a few kids, cadet journalists, typists, whatever, to prove that unemployment is a crock. Tell them to say they're unemployed, unqualified, but willing to try anything. They're neat, tidy, well-spoken, they'll get jobs. And they did, these cadets and typists from the Murdoch Telegraph. Jobs, if you can call casual waitering and telephone canvassing jobs, thereby adding fuel to the fires stoked by resentment and ignorance via the front page of that newspaper. What a scoop. Four well-presented middle-class kids with the ineffable confidence implicit in the self-knowledge that they already have jobs, real jobs, actually being accepted for minimum wage drudgery in preference to inarticulate flannelette shirted kids from western suburbs high schools. Who would have thought that possible? It's certainly not the crude, brutal bullying the nasty bastards at Ray Martin's 6:30 program did to the Paxton kids, but it's not substantially different. And it certainly is false, misleading and deceptive. Next, the rubric of they'll never know the difference, for which you need to understand that the television networks all maintain overseas offices, not to cover overseas stories, but to have a program buyer on the spot, and even more importantly, a plausible justification for senior executives' junkets. But those offices are made colourably necessary by posting a journalist there, whose job is to repackage what's already been pulled off the wok, that's trade talk for the satellite, unless, of course, it's a really big story, in which case they just pull it off the wok and forget about their correspondent. It's in the repackaging that the problems arise, but only if someone knows the difference. You may remember there was an IRA bomb threat at the running of the Grand National at Aintree in the very far north of England this year. So the Australian network's reporters on the spot did their pieces to camera where? At Aintree? No, in the streets of London. But they said they're at Aintree. The ABC's man, we thought somewhat triumphantly, stood in front of a Nash terrace in Regent's Park. Channel 9's man stood in front of New Scotland Yard. See how it works? Bombs, police, we've all heard of New Scotland Yard. Got nothing to do with the north of England, but that'll do. And still with the ABC, when the Timothy McVeigh trial was going on, the ABC's man, and that was in Denver, Colorado, the ABC's man stood in front of a building and did a piece to camera about the trial, and all you could see was the words VER behind his head, FBI building. His head was obviously blocking out DEN. As it turned out, it was blocking out HOO. It was the J. Edgar Hoover building in Washington. But, as I said, they'll never know the difference. Then there was the Seven Network's witness program, in which Paul Barry pretended he was the reporter on a story about the crash of TWA 800 off Long Island, New York. What that required him to do was edit out the English reporter from Panorama, who had actually made the story, and stand in front of aircraft at Sydney's Kingsford Smith Airport. But, you know, the princes, the nonpareils, the very quintessential experts of this kind of sleight of hand all work at Channel 7 at a program called Today Tonight. They, of course, are David Richardson, a reporter, and Chris Adams, a producer. They put together the story to the effect that Christopher Skase, the much-reviled Mallorca fugitive, is so powerful that the island's police force runs interference for him, blocking the way of decent Aussie journos, bent on exposing the miscreant. So much in the pocket of Skase are the Mallorca cops, we were told, that they harassed the representatives of Truth, Justice and the Ratings, searching their hotel rooms, setting up roadblocks, all in order to snatch their incriminating videotape that proved Mr. Skase was alive and well and should be extradited to Australia forthwith. Only, as everybody knows, the whole thing was a fake. The image of Richardson at the wheel of a car speeding around a roadblock, breathlessly declaring, "Let's get out of here," was shot not on Mallorca, but with unconscious irony in the theatrical district of Barcelona. There was no roadblock, and Richardson was acting, or not to put too fine a point on it, lying. So was his producer. Why do they never sue me? And what happened to them when that lie was exposed? Well, the thunderous action of the Seven Network was to send Mr. Richardson and Mr. Adams on holiday for a month, confident that the public's memory is shorter than that. Many people have asked me, how did they think they were going to get away with it? The first answer is that they were very unlucky not to get away with it. It was only spotted by a barrister friend of mine who happens to know the theatrical district of Barcelona like the back of his hand. And, of course, the second answer is that they did get away with it. That perennial chase for Skase is but one epitome of the wholly un-Australian, or so we would like to believe, but time-honoured journalistic tradition of kicking a man when he's down, but make sure you've got steel caps on your boots. For instance, everybody hates Mal Colston. Nobody's going to mumble anything, not in the ranks of the mass media anyway, about presumptions of innocence or prejudging the issues. So by all means, victimise his family. Besiege his home, camp in his drive, bring in a crane and a cherry picker so you can get pictures from outside over the tops of the trees to his house. Hammer on the door so you can film whoever answers it, look at their guilty faces. And sooner or later you'll provoke an angry outburst in front of the cameras, which can then be shown in all its humiliating detail to the whole nation. And they did that, but it still wasn't enough. They all got footage when one of the Colston sons came out of the house and walked down that long drive to ask them to keep off the private property, quite calmly and politely. But he was insulted, pushed, and eventually provoked into an angry response. What did they do with the footage of that? They edited it, changing the sequence of events and cutting out their own misconduct to create a deliberately false, misleading, and deceptive report. And none worse than the reports presented by Glenn Milne for 7 and Laurie Oakes for 9. Media Watch was able to demonstrate the dishonesty of the videotape editing because we got hold of an unedited copy of the tape. Not that any of that troubles the newspaper journalists. They routinely reorder events to suit themselves, and the existence of television footage isn't going to change that. The Murdoch Telegraph was sufficiently emboldened by the events at the Colston House and the certitudinous belief that they could say anything they liked about the Colston family that they used the following headline for their story. Photographer felled in scuffles at the rat hole. And then there's another who didn't get away with it, being the food critic. Isn't that a wonderful expression? It always makes me think of a man shouting at a sausage. Stephen Downes, who writes for the Sunday Age and the Australian Financial Review. What he didn't get away with was a conflict of interests that involved his being paid to puff the restaurants at the New Melbourne Casino and then, a few weeks later, to write what were allegedly objective reviews of those same restaurants. They have a lot of trouble with that in Melbourne. the Herald Sun employs people to write about wine and cheese who are actually in the pay of those who sell the very wine and cheese of which they write. It's a little hard to make the Herald Sun understand that there is a problem with that. Next, some instances of what I might term sleight of hand. Appetizer. Appetizer has the cheek to run on Saturdays, or had the cheek to run on Saturdays, a section called Insight. That's a name stolen from the pre-Murdoch, I hasten to add, English Sunday Times, where it referred to the best team anybody's ever seen in English language journalism of investigative reporters, including Philip Knightley. They were the ones who shamed distillers over the thalidomide litigation. They are the ones who told the truth about the British Army in Northern Ireland. It was customary for the Insight team to devote months to researching their stories, and then the Tizer took over the name. In its travesty of that kind of fearless and honourable public service journalism, the Adelaide paper produced 15 special reports on South Australia's economic future. An incredulous readership, you persons in other words, was confronted with unrelentingly upbeat, optimistic analysis that depicted this city as the centre of the world, with a limitless future in technology, culture and booming employment. Only by examining the Hansard of a parliamentary estimates committee could one learn, or did one learn, as we did, that the series of articles was euphemistically categorised as a, quote, joint venture between the Murdoch monolith and the South Australian government. The Advertiser, whose staff reported, wrote, illustrated and edited the articles, was paid $75,000 to include them in the paper. Not that the readers were told that. The intention was that the readers would believe the articles were genuine. There's long been, you know, a Murdoch culture born of necessity. In a one newspaper town, and most capital cities in this nation are one newspaper towns, it's a brave journalist who won't go along with the Murdoch first, ethics a very distant second philosophy. Let me give you a further instance from the Tizer, as if you don't know already. AFL is Adelaide's game. Rupert's acquisition of a large slice of rugby league, which is perfect for the gaping maw of television and pay TV, it rates well where they know the game, it satisfies quotas for local production, and it costs bugger all to screen, requires, though, because Rupert had bought into it, a Super League team in Adelaide. So he creates a following for it, doesn't he? Hence the Advertiser's front page, sports columns and principles, such as they might be, are subverted to the cause, Murdoch loyalty first, or what are you doing in your next job? The culture is not, however, materially different in the Packer Colossus. The English-speaking world's finest television interviewer, Ray, Martin, is pitchforked into the studio with James Packer, probing him deeply with such questions as, would you like to propose to Kate Fisher live on national television? But more importantly, reading out a set of Dorothy Dix's so that Packer Mark III can assure anyone who's listening, the whole of Australia in other words, that his father's corporation has every right to take over Fairfax and would never interfere in the editorial judgment of the journalists. It was Les Majestés, I suppose, for Media Watch to counterpoint James Packer's spin-doctored straight face with his father's sworn evidence before the parliamentary inquiry to the effect that he agreed his network ownership precluded him from newspaper ownership in the national interest, and that he'd always believed a proprietor had a perfect right to use his papers to push his own barrow. If it's a crime for life to imitate art, they ought to lock up all those who work on A Current Affair and Barcelona Tonight and throw away the key. We all laughed, didn't we, when the frontline team created stories. You remember Mike, popularity was slipping, so Bruno Lawrence said, well, we'll have to get him a crippled child to be his friend. Or one with AIDS, but he has to have caught it in a nice way. But there was nothing funny when Ray Martin imported from Papua New Guinea a family with the happily photogenic problem of Siamese twins, under no significant risk of dying when surgically separated, and Ray wrote and spoke that deathless line about them coming to Melbourne and called them summer people in winter clothes. Well worth $1 million a year, I say. And you might equally recall that Frontline had the victim of one of their fictional entrapments committing suicide. That wasn't funny, but it was surely ironic. And less than 2 weeks ago, Ray Martin was given the Packer Spin Doctor's script to read, and there wasn't a word of apology in it, you might have noted, after Mr. Benny Mendoza hanged himself in his garage after 3 days of hammer blow promos for ACA, followed by a program item that labelled him as a dishonest television repairman. Martin's self-justification was, quote, we didn't hound him. No, but they did lie to him, entrap him and vilify him. Any mildly thoughtful journalist would have realised that a man in Mr. Mendoza's position and with his cultural background might well suicide after such treatment, and his alleged wrongdoing was a great deal less significant than that of the journalist who purported to expose him. Not that the ABC escapes the net. As we've had cause to note, Robin Williams turned over his program and his credibility to the paid publicist for the Uncle Ben's dog food people. Paul Grabowski didn't know there was anything wrong with having other people conduct interviews and then editing himself asking the questions. ABC radio programs have been easy meat for publicists generally, despite the practice having already been exposed and forbidden. And all program commissioning procedures went out the window when Bill Kelty pulled the Old Mates Act on Brian Johns and the Whitlam Lectures deal saw the ABC hand editorial control to outsiders. Elsewhere, The Age labelled a boy on a motorbike as the person who lit the Dandenong bushfires. And when that turned into a fireball likely to consume most of their defamation verdict allocation, what did they do? No apology. They blamed the police for their own incompetence and they called the boy a hero in a make-good story. They seem to have got away with it. Editors of some Fairfax newspapers, unwilling to give offence to a man they were sure would become their boss sooner or later, excised from news stories about companies with poor records in corporate governance any reference to PBL, Mr. Kerry Packer's PBL. Rupert Murdoch flew into Sydney on one of his awe-inspiring visits, and suddenly his tabloid, which had John Howard as a fatally gutless 90-pound weakling, saw the light, and Mr. Wishy-Washy became Mr. Tough. And in Canberra, when an anonymous government hatchet person was assigned to neutralise the Stolen Generation report by smearing the character of Sir Ronald Wilson, what did the press gallery do? Did they expose the dirty tricks practitioner? Did they tell him or her they wouldn't have a bar of such cowardly and unethical scandalising? Did they what? They ran it. Now, that's a fair old litany of misconduct by people who hold themselves out as guardians of the truth, people whose professional code has this preamble. Respect for truth and the public's right to information are overriding principles for all journalists. People whose ethics forbid the suppression of relevant facts from their stories, prohibit them from being influenced in their professional duties by commercial considerations, including their employer's commercial interests, insist that they shall use only fair and honest means to obtain their stories and pictures, and require that they do their utmost to correct anything they've published or broadcast that is found to be harmfully inaccurate. Oh yeah, when's the last time you saw that? And my overview has had to leave out journalistic hypocrisy, exemplified by tabloid populist attacks on politicians' overseas junkets, but not the emptying out of every Australian newsroom to go to Hong Kong to cover a royal visit in reverse. As this overview has omitted proprietorial hypocrisy, whenever the Press Council, and God knows it isn't often, produces an adjudication with some potential for embarrassment. and the shameful performance of the entire Australian mass media in its treatment of the Pauline Hanson story. But there isn't time to go into that. What I've just reviewed were merely some of the ethical breaches that are the stock in trade of Australian journalists. Not just a handful of the disreputable ones, but the highest profile, award-winning leaders of the game. The important point I want to make to you is that those are all quotidian examples of Australian media purporting to do its job. Each one is, to a greater or lesser degree, a disgrace. Each one represents a betrayal of the trust that the community reposes in its journalists because it has no choice. We don't trust them because they deserve our trust. We trust them because we have no other means of obtaining the information that they hold themselves out as providing honestly and professionally. Journalists form a particular group of unquestionable significance in this community. They are a group entrusted with the exercise of considerable power. What they write and construct has profound influences on how the community votes, how it perceives itself, its level of tolerance and decency, and in many other areas of perceptions that inform its daily life. The community wouldn't wish that power to be reposed in people whose honesty, ability, and personal standards are questionable. So it is thus necessary that there be standards of conduct for journalists, and that they be enforceable in a system that includes public participation and appropriately coercive powers. There is far too much cheating and dishonesty in Australian journalism, too many subtle and not so subtle conflicts of interest. There's racism, there's deliberate exclusion of contrary points of view, and yet nothing happens to those who are guilty of it. That's because the community, we consumers of the mass media, have no right to bring the media to account for the way it exercises its power and exerts its influence. When they cheat, there's nothing we can do about it, and there is no independent body with any responsibility to represent the public interest. Now, the examples of those trade practices actions that I gave at the beginning offer no comfort. While advertisers, to whose blandishments we are all inured anyway, can be and will be brought to account for misleading us and fined large amounts of money, $45 million in one case, successive federal governments have chosen, however, to protect media owners from the operation of that law, as they have with the law of privacy. The media have, in relation to their non-advertising activities, been made exempt from a system of public interest regulation that applies to every other corporation. Is it not the worst kind of humbug that the Australian Consumer and Competition Commission can and does prosecute mass media corporations for dishonesty in their self-promotional activities, but is prevented by law from prosecuting their dishonesty in their informational activities? Which of those activities matter most? Nationwide News was fined $120,000 a year ago for misleading the public about a free mobile phone promotion. And Network 10 had to settle a prosecution after being found guilty of advertorials which made false representations about a Gold Coast land promotion. As a result of this government-granted protection for the media as information providers, and directly affected by the ever-tightening concentration of ownership of our print and electronic media, public confidence in media standards is probably at its lowest level in living memory. With the creation of new media, ownership concentration is certain to increase, meaning that it's not only the journalists' conduct we need to scrutinise, it is also that of their employers. The latter is an area that's received no attention at all, and that's probably because the politicians were at dinner with them at the time. Actually, they were waiting on their tables. They know their place. Yet the public interest issues of new media, multimedia, cross-media ownership, monopolies, conflicts of interest, and false and misleading conduct all scream out for one cogent set of enforceable rules. That there are no such rules is in itself the clearest evidence of their necessity, because it proves the power of the tycoons. The Press Council is concerned only with print. That is a body with no coercive powers and a stated unwillingness to assume any such powers, a body which can't even secure the participation of the journalists in its deliberations, a body with a pitiful record of dealing with public complaints, a lapdog which has solemnly decreed that journalists certainly don't need facts, a belief will be good enough to justify the destruction of reputations, and whose chairman had this to say last May, the system of self-regulation works well because people here are telling us that the Fairfax newspapers are superb examples of journalism. They're not supervised, they're not regulated by the government, and work according to the code of practice established by the Press Council and by the media at large. Even today, Professor Flint, author of those stirring words, has said that the Australian media shouldn't in any way be blamed in respect of what happened in Paris to Diana Spencer. He says they shouldn't be blamed for something somebody else did. And as we all know, of course, New Idea, TV Week, and Women's Day, Women's Weekly, never buy paparazzi pictures, do they? The Australian Press Council, ladies and gentlemen, is a body with which I will trouble you no further. And hard as you may find this to believe, one of the reasons given by the chairman of the Press Council to justify the present situation of the mass media being unaccountable is that Media Watch exists. Well, whatever we may do at Media Watch, we certainly don't accept the role of media policemen. The Broadcasting Authority, which has proved a statutory enactment of laissez-faire, is, I note, soon to be headed by none other than the chairman of the Press Council. His impending appointment may explain why he said this on the ABC program First Wednesday. What should be put in place of the cross-media rules is a legal regime which removes the control of who owns the media from government and puts it into a body which operates under the rule of law. That is, he would say, me. The journalist's own ethical tribunal is another entity of, shall I say, little credibility. It boasts the doubtful achievement of having, as one of the members of its judiciary tribunal, a person who pleaded guilty to criminal offences concerned with forgery of bail documents and perversion of the course of justice in order to secure an exclusive interview with a murderer for a current affair. At the same time he was forging the documents and lying to police about what he'd done, his employer was putting up $50,000 to secure the prisoner's bail. The journalist's been dealt with by the criminal court, but his employer, Mr. Packer, never will be. So it can be seen that a formulation of an enforceable code for media proprietors is no less urgent than for the practitioners. There's something indecent about unaccountable journalists and unaccountable owners demanding more power against the community. But that's what they're doing, seeking what they're pleased to call shield laws to shield them from us, no less, and reform of the only protection the community has, the law of libel. To a degree, they're getting what they want, or should I say demand. State by state, the public is being dragged out of the system. Juries have either been abolished or denied any real role in the process. The public, the tycoons have shouted at receptive politicians, there's no need to shout, just whisper. The public is too stupid to understand the complexity of free speech. It awards too much in damages, and governments, buckling to their own conflict of interest, listen and do their bidding. The attempts to agree on a uniform defamation code in this country have been dominated by proposals to remove any privacy protection from the law. The shame of it, you know, is that only through the exercise of what the media say is their business, that is free speech, are we going to get any kind of discussion about the need to regulate the conduct of the mass media and to make that regulatory system enforceable. But of course, we won't get that debate in media controlled by the people who control it now. Let me leave you with this story about journalists. It seems there was a journalist, a priest, and a surgeon. This is a joke. Who used to play golf every Monday. They'd done it for years and they were all members of the club. On a particular Monday, they turned up to play their game and there were two men in front of them on the first tee, the worst pair of duffers anybody had ever seen. They hooked the ball, they sliced the ball, they took air shots at the ball. They hardly spent any time on the fairway at all. They took 8 and 10 putts to get down when they did get to the green, and they would not call through the threesome. 4 hours after they started, they got to the ninth hole. So the journalist, the surgeon and the priest went in to see the manager of the club. They threw their clubs down on the floor of his office and demanded that he do something. He said, "What, those two men out on the 10th tee?" "Yes." "What, you want me to take them off the course?" "Yes." "They're blind, you know." "Oh," said the priest, "well, I'm going out to ask them to forgive me." And he looked at the surgeon and said, "Are you coming?" And the surgeon said, "Of course. I operate on people and I tell them to rehabilitate themselves, and it'd just be hypocrisy for me to take this stance." So they both looked at the journalist. "Can't they play at night?" he said.
Thank you, Stuart. We're going to... what are we going to do, Judith? Are we going to draw the raffle now? We're going to move on to questions. Questions, okay. Our normal habit is to ask our working media members to ask the first questions, and therefore I'd like to ask if there are any questions. Someone over here, I think. Please identify yourself.
Ian Henschke, ABC. Only been on your program once, so...
Keep trying.
Yeah. What I'd like to ask is that you do such a magnificent job on journalists. Have you ever thought about doing a job on lawyers? Because really, if there was another group that were down there with us, it would have to be lawyers.
You're thinking of car salesmen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I was actually speaking to someone only an hour ago about a story, and I said, "What's happening with this particular story?" And they said, "Well, the lawyers have got involved." It was to do with the Bolivar Pong. I don't know whether you're aware of this, but in South Australia for probably...
They do like to talk, journalists, don't
they? Yeah, well, I think lawyers get paid a lot for it too, actually. I think about $300 an hour was the last quote. What's the QC's rate these days? Touché. Okay. But basically, I would like to ask if you thought there would be a reasonable program on television or on the radio called Legal Watch, where we could examine what the legal profession does, because I think you do such a great job with media, but I would assume that most people in this room have a few problems with lawyers. And if there is a problem with the media, maybe it's to do with the law.
Well, Ian, I thought it was the job of journalists to do those sorts of things. Next.
Actually, Ian, you might be rather interested, just before Rick gets in here, to hear Stuart's opinion about the localisation, or rather the centralisation, of the 7:30 report.
Which is very adverse. I think it is a terrible thing that the ABC, in the name of whatever it is, economies, has removed from Adelaide, Brisbane, Perth, Hobart and Melbourne their own nightly current affairs program. I mean, if Channel 7 can do it, if Channel 7 can do something, the ABC must do it. The idea of these empty studios around the country in ABC buildings is appalling to me. The result that we see in the 7:30 report, the national version, is that an Adelaide story or a South Australian story will only get on if it's absolutely bizarre. The ordinary affairs of each state are simply not covered, and it's not an answer to say there's a statewide program, a state line program on Friday nights. That is no replacement for five nights a week current affairs. You just get the amplitude squashed to nothing. And they are going to do it with television news as well, I don't have the slightest doubt. And it would appear, I don't know if any of you saw last night's Media Watch, but those who are currently running ABC television news would appear really to have no idea what they should be doing.
Rex Jury is the associate editor of the Advertiser.
We've got you once or twice, Rex.
I think only I think three times, but I'll keep trying. Three times, but I'll keep trying. I'm asking the question that I think everyone wants to ask. You only mentioned paparazzi once, but do you believe, and this is a personal view, do you believe that there should be some form of tightening of controls, A, on the purchase of material by Australian publications, of material from paparazzi from overseas, and how could that be instituted? And B, do you believe that there should be further controls on the actions of, I guess we call them paparazzi, but then the broader media in similar activities within Australia?
I think there's a broader question which overarches the question of the purchase of that sort of material, and it's all about the right to privacy. It's a very important discussion. It's a subject upon which I speak as often as I can. We are all entitled to privacy in this country as a matter of international legal obligations, since Australia acceded to the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights 12 years ago, withdrawing all reservations. Our governments, state and federal, have been under an obligation to enact laws protecting our privacy. They won't do it because Packer and Murdoch are telling them not to do it, despite their international law obligation to do it. It really demonstrates to you who the most powerful people in the country are. And who am I to disagree with the Washington correspondent of Mr. Murdoch's Sunday Times, who shortly after he left that employment wrote in The Guardian that in Australia the government is a wholly owned subsidiary of the News Corporation. And their privacy is a complex and important issue that, again, like media regulation, will not be discussed in the media because it is anathema to their commercial interests. Mr. Mendoza, who was driven to his death by Channel 9 and A Current Affair, would have been protected in the United States of America by the privacy laws. He would have been protected anywhere in Europe by privacy laws. The only privacy law we have ever had in this country is the Commonwealth Privacy Act of 1988, which only protects the dissemination of information you give to Commonwealth agencies like the Taxation Office and the Department of Social Security. Last year, Attorney General Darrell Williams announced that he was going to extend the provisions of the Privacy Act to the private sector. He has since reneged on that. Nothing is going to happen on that front. There is such a thing as the public's right to know. Diana Spencer was to be photographed, if at all, in a public place. The laws of privacy that are in place in France, Europe generally, and in the United States would not prevent paparazzi photography. That is, to my mind, a matter of ethical conduct. If the magazines that I mentioned before don't buy those photographs, then nobody will take those photographs. That is what I'm talking about, a system of enforceable standards that apply to editors, proprietors, and individual journalists. All these things keep cropping up at a pragmatic, individualised, uncogent, if you like, level, because we don't have a system for looking at control of these things. So I've taken a very long time to answer your question. Obviously, there is a case for imposing ethical standards, which the journalists allegedly impose on themselves. But what journalist knows anything of his own or her own code of ethics? The only thing they can ever tell you is that there's a provision there about not disclosing sources. As to obligations to respect privacy, and there is one of them, they don't know about that, and even if they do, they certainly don't act on it. So what the community has to have is a body to which it can go, an independent body, knowing that there are certain immutable standards that have to be imposed, have to be enforceable, and produce as a result a responsible media. It just becomes so much more important when all the media are in two sets of hands, because the journalists who work for Mr. Murdoch know very well that their first duty is to their own employment, not to the standards of it. Ethics come a very distant second, where it's that job or nothing.
Steve Howard, I think, got a question.
Steve Howard from the Advertiser, Reverend Littlemore. Thank you for the sermon. And I must say, every Monday night, I am an avid watcher of your program. And I think you do a fantastic job. You certainly earn my 8 cents a day. Next, I would just like to say, during your delivery, there's one thing that I found, and if the maligned sub-editors had got hold of your script, would have looked closely at every Australian newsroom being empty to go to Hong Kong. I would put that in somewhat of a beat-up department, but you got away with it that time. Can I ask you, the Packer family won't get the Fairfax Company for their Christmas present?
Not this Christmas.
Perhaps not. Why is the government procrastinating, and why would it seem, apparently, that the Fairfax organisation is a sacred cow, a protected species?
Well, the government is procrastinating because the Senate won't do it. They now know that they're not going to get it in the Senate. It must be that Senator Harradine has let his intention be known. And as to why is the Fairfax organisation a sacred cow, I don't know the answer to that. I think the truth is that the two broadsheets, the Herald in Sydney and the Age in Melbourne, have considerable traditions that none of the other papers have. And I think amongst middle-class people, people in the AA and AB categories, those are the papers they've always taken. People have an affection for newspapers, as you know very well. If you grow up reading, David Marr said it at one of those dinners that they had for the Friends of Fairfax, that people grumble about their newspaper, but they inevitably buy it. That applies in Adelaide just as anywhere else. But it can only be said that the reason the government won't act to give the newspapers to Packer is that they know they would lose that in the Senate. I'm quite sure that's the sole and only reason. It's got nothing to do with the national interest.
There's a question over there somewhere, I think. Oh, Samala Harris.
Samala Harris from the Advertiser. I think I speak for everybody here in a sense of disappointment. Whilst we've heard many of your laudable themes, we feel denied an instalment on the most brilliant and loud, all-known herbs and spices, limp-falling columnist, Piers Ackerman.
Well, all I can say is there always seems to be something getting up his nose.
My question was there a particular relationship?
And that is all I can say.
Samala and Stuart, I've got a thought crime to confess. I rang Piers up last night and said, why did you come across today for lunch? Because I thought you might have something interesting to talk to Stuart about on the plane. He couldn't make it, but he did tell me that the Daily Telegraph yesterday put on a circulation increase with the Di and Dodi drama of 120,000 copies.
Brad Crouch from the Sunday Mail. You've spoken of the Trade Practices Act as a tool to perhaps regulate journalism. Just want to check, that's something that can be regulated by government, amended by government, and we're in a climate now where there's calls for more government regulations of journalism. In South Australia, the state government has black banned the state political reporter of the only Sunday paper here purely on a personality clash basis with the Premier. The word's gone out from the Premier, an official directive, no minister or press secretary is to talk to him. He's not the most loved journalist in Australia. He can be a prickly character, but he is our political correspondent. Where do you suggest, you've suggested more regulation, more perhaps ways to rein journalists in. Where do you draw the line on government regulation to make sure it doesn't go so far that they, as they said officially, they can dictate to who they talk to?
That's got nothing to do with regulation, Brett. I remember when I was a cadet journalist, I went to the old Trades Hall in Sydney when there was a strike on, and journalists were let in to cover the stop work meeting. We used to go down there a lot. And I can't remember who this particular strike was, but the first vote they took was to exclude the representative of the then Packer Telegraph from the meeting. And he or she, I can't remember who it was, got up and left. And I looked at the other journalists. I was just a wet behind the ears cadet. And I thought, well, we'll all go, won't we? You know, such is journalists' respect for their rights and mutual rights. But of course, none of them went. Now, is that not the answer? I mean, journalists have got the answer in their own hands. You know, if government, it's like Pauline Hanson. People ought to ignore her. Journalists ought to have the guts not to cover it. And if a particular journalist is being excluded from access to the government, I thought journalists believed in solidarity of their craft. I would have thought they were bound all to say, fine, one out, all out. But of course, one determines the standards and principles of journalists by how they react to those situations. It's got nothing to do with regulations of government or anything else. It's about principle.
Here's an old tabloid newspaper man, John Lobbard of ABC TV.
Stuart, you're one day ahead of Lachlan Murdoch in Adelaide. He arrives here tomorrow. Lachlan... I'm sorry. I work at television, you see. Stuart, we're delighted to see you in Adelaide, but you're a day ahead of Lachlan Murdoch, who's due in town tomorrow. He's got a big task ahead of him. How do you rate Lachlan Murdoch? Do you think he has a big job ahead of him in running the company, News Corp? It's a big... He's got Daddy looking over his shoulder, presumably, all the time.
I haven't got the faintest idea. I'm trying to get an interview with Mr. Murdoch so I can apprise myself of his capacities. Yes. It's interesting, isn't it, that people in the information business are so... reticent with information about what motivates them, what they believe in. That would be a short answer, I suppose. And why they're doing it. But it's one of those... I had something like 25 calls yesterday, people wanting me to talk about the paparazzi thing, and the response that I made and my program made was that we just didn't know enough about it. And as it turns out today, that was right, wasn't it? It's a very different situation from the ones that people were only too free to comment on yesterday. The answer is, I don't know.
A question from Rudolf Toyson of the Catholic Media Centre.
You're making a great deal of the issue of ownership of the media and the influence of proprietors over editorial standards. You said that many journalists saw their first obligation in to their owners rather than to any ethical standards in journalism. I'd like you to clarify that point. Do you see any inherent problem in private ownership of media, and would you like to do away with that?
No, I don't see any inherent problem in people starting newspapers, though God knows nobody will ever start another newspaper in this country. It simply cannot be done. And that's what we're facing up to. There are probably more newspapers in this country today than there will be in 2 years' time, and many more than there will be in 10 years' time. They will go the same way as the ABC's individual state services have gone. They'll go the way the afternoon newspapers have gone. Of course, there's nothing inherently wrong in private ownership of the mass media. If there weren't private ownership, there would be no mass media. But the ABC must not be robbed of the ability to participate in that market as well. It struck me as the most terrible irony that the one area where this government has said there must be no budgetary cuts is defence. We have no enemies other than Mr. Packer and Mr. Murdoch. Who I seriously say are a much greater threat to Australia's well-being than is President Suharto. But the ABC, our only defence against those people, has been robbed of the capacity to compete with them or even to tell the truth about them. So I have no problem at all with the private sector being engaged in the mass media, but there must be an articulate ABC to get in there and mix it with them.
Simon Jemison from the Australian Financial Review. See, you're doing a bit of lobbying over there already, Simon.
Yeah. Stuart, I'm the only Fairfax representative in this room, and I think it's a tragedy that my own employer doesn't have a Sydney Morning Herald, Age, BRW representative, and won't have a Fin Review correspondent for a month. So I hope you continue to look at Adelaide and its lack of media diversity. That said, I enjoyed your program last night, particularly the heroin issue. I'm wondering if that says something about the Australian media's attitude in the 90s to championing causes. Without looking back at the TDT days, Has the media changed its attitude towards maybe championing social issues, be it Mabo or WIC or heroin? It seems to me maybe the media has changed its attitude to what is important and what it likes to pursue. Have you noticed any change in championing causes through the media?
Yes, I think it's a good point. If you take just the drug problem in Australia, and as a criminal lawyer, I do a lot of criminal law, I've spent the last nearly 18 years dealing with people from time to time who are addicted to heroin or who have dealt in heroin or imported it or something else. And I've seen the full range of the effect of the criminal law. It is quite ludicrous for the tabloid attitude to be, all we need are tougher laws. The laws couldn't be any tougher than they are now, short of the death penalty. It wouldn't make any difference anyway. So, and the media, journalists, individual journalists, have done nothing about the issue that we have to abandon failed drug policy. I can remember the one program I ever saw on television where the decriminalisation argument was mounted, and it was 6 years ago. Even the Herald, the Sydney Morning Herald, when it has run articles or pieces advocating a new attitude because everything else has failed, will not do it with its own journalists. They always get Ron Penny or Alec Wodak or lawyers or ex-judges or somebody else to write it. They still won't stick their own necks out. There, I think, was one editorial in the Sydney Morning Herald in favour of the ACT heroin trial, one. And as I said in the script last night, it came far too late. By then, all the harm had been done, Howard had been turned round, and nothing the Herald did or said was going to make any difference. I think there has been a terrible climate of selfishness about journalists and crusades. Investigative reporting of the kind that Ben Hills used to do doesn't exist anymore. You get that terrible prostitution of it that I referred to by calling the Saturday Advertiser paid material insight. I mean, that's the level to which things have descended. There is no honour anymore given to the expostulation of unpopular views which have to be voiced. I think there are real problems with journalists' motivation in that area. It may well be it's a product of the fact that their editors will not run this stuff if it's written, but whatever the reason, we are missing out on all the big debates. And it is a shame.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, we're coming up to 2 o'clock and we like to finish as close to as we can, so I think I'll keep it to two last questions. Alec Matheson's got one, and then Stephen Middleton, I think, wants to ask. Alec, where are you?
Stuart, I've been patiently waiting for the main media to finish with their startling questions. I'm actually with Suburban Newspapers, Messenger. Also owned by Lachlan. My question is, you're very critical of the Press Council. Apart from yourself, who do you think should be appointed to monitor the media?
Well, I thought that was what my whole speech was about. I think there has to be an independent body, an administrative or domestic tribunal, whatever you want to call it, which has a set of enforceable rules that are produced in cooperation with the journalists and their proprietors and perhaps people in advertising and promotional industries as well. And then somebody's got to be put at the head of it. It's not a matter of naming an individual. We have all sorts of administrative tribunals in this country for which people are qualified to head them. I don't think there's any difficulty about the choice of those who preside over such a body. The difficulty is persuading our political masters that we are entitled to have such a body.
Okay, last question. Steve Middleton.
Stuart, as a journalist with 20 years' experience in newspapers, I think I report you accurately when you described a litany of misconduct by those who hold themselves out to be the guardians of the truth. If you're going to set yourself up as judge, jury and executioner of the media, as I believe you do, I think you ought to get your facts right. When you talked about the frontline kidnapper who committed suicide, it was in fact not the kidnapper who committed suicide, he shot the hostages. I
That's
take great pleasure
story.
In catching frontline out
story.
Tonight.
That's a different story. Different script.
You had your fact wrong, though, Stuart.
But that's
said
a different
the
script. Right,
you
okay.
said the hostage had shot the... had committed suicide, when in fact it was the kidnapper who shot the hostages. But the thing that I find really curious about this is the urging journalists not to report Pauline Hanson. Since when do journalists have the responsibility of deciding who should be reported and who shouldn't? Surely a journalist's responsibility is to report what the community is saying and doing, observing and noting around them. Theirs is not the judgment as to who was right or wrong, surely.
Yeah, let's get every bigot and racist and give them a front page, eh? Not on my press, thanks.
I think you all realise how much effort and indeed 9 years of Media Watch experience has gone into those thoughts from Stuart Littlemore. I'd like you to thank him in the usual way with me. Stuart, it's been our custom to give our guest speaker a gift of this type, so we're not trying to bribe you. He tells me that he didn't drink for 20 years after getting out of journalism, which sounds pretty sensible to me. However, these days he has one glass of red a night, and this will last you for a few nights. Tony, I think it would be really appropriate if we asked Judith Bleachmore to draw the raffle for us. Judith, where are you?
Judith, come on up here. Judith Bleachmore.
I'll be the wheel girl and she can draw it, okay?
Robert's going to be the wheel girl and you can draw it. Now, I know you've all got a lot to talk about, but just for one moment, while we draw some raffle prizes. We've got a $50 voucher from Rigoni's Bistro in Lee Street, that wonderful little Italian restaurant. And is Alan Roger here with the voucher? Alan, are you here? Down the corner. Roger. Thank you, Roger, very much. Do you want to come up with it? Lisa Brett, where are you? Lisa... $50 voucher from Rigoni's. Alan's got it here for you. Okay, we've got another $50 voucher from the Rock Lobster Cafe in Gouges Street. And Alan's got that voucher too. Thank you, Alan, for this. And it is to... Arcadden of Edwardstown. Where are you? Where are you? D67. Terrific, thank you, from the Rock Lobster Cafe. Now, the lucky person who's going to win, take 10 people to the Royal Show. Thank you, Francine Connor, thank you. C48, which is a green, is that green? Greeny colour ticket. Ah, there you go. Get along to the Royal Show this week. You're going to have a big time. There's two more. We have some Hahn Premium. Robbie Cooter from SA Brewing. I don't know whether you're here or not, are you? Robbie, thank you. A carton of Hahn Premium. And it is an orange ticket X34. And it is to Gail Charlton?
Chalton?
Gail? There you are, Gail. Thank you, Hahn Premium. And we have one more that's just come to light. We have a night's accommodation here at the Hindley Park Royal, thanks to the Hindley Park Royal who came and gave us that today. Lynn Parnell, W66. Lynn, thank you to the Hindley Park Royal. And of course, ladies and gentlemen, a reminder that we have our next luncheon on Wednesday, the 8th of October, with Paul Kelly from The Australian. Thank you for your attendance today.